All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that was Sandy Nelson with Let There Be Drums, and that's what we need today. I want all the drums beating all over the city, all over the country. Get those drums loud and clear and waking people up and reminding them to open up their ears to wherever they are. Turn on that radio. Sit down next to the radio. Fire up the computer. Whatever you got to do to access this show, you got to do it, because we have a very special show for you today. And opening the show up, I'm very, very pleased to be bringing you part four of the five-part interview I did with Bob Avakian a little while ago. In this part of the interview, we concentrate on the question of whether it's really possible to have a liberated socialist society with whole new ways of relating to each other and to the world, and a society that's actually on its way to, that's struggling to get to, a communist world, a world where people, human beings, are truly emancipated. And in digging into this question, we get into questions like, what about human nature with all of its me first and screw the rest of you outlook? And what is revolutionary morality, and what difference will that make in a socialist society? Now, like I said, this is part four of the five-part interview, and if you missed any of the first three parts, you should check it out at the KPFK archives at kpfk.org, or go to revcom.us. Again, that's revcom.us, where you'll have access to all three segments. And a whole lot more about the movement for revolution that Bob Avakian is leading. So without any further ado, listen up and let's get into it. Bob Avakian being interviewed by me, Michael Slate.
One of the things that is, again, very important in terms of being able to get there, to get to a new society in the first place, is having a vision, having actually an idea of that, and people broadly having an idea of this society, both in it being visionary, but also in it being viable. The fact that there's actually this possibility, that it's a real possibility, that it's viable, that people can you know, look at what's been done. And a big part, and that actually plays into a lot in terms of this, again, this question of hammering away at this notion of we can't do any better than where we are now. You know, and there's a whole point that you've done. You've done all this work in the new synthesis of communism that you've developed and brought out into the world, and the idea that what the society can be, looking at the experience of the past and figuring out the problems that it had and correcting that and developing whole new pathways to actually create the kind of society that you've said and others have said is not only, you know, it's not only a new society, but it's a place it's a place that people would want to live, and they could actually live with the dignity of human beings and be part of a process of creating a society, of a transition, of a transformation, a society that's in transformation to something that would be the emancipation of humanity as a whole. And like I'm saying, that's something that's really come out as something that's very important in people's thinking, and they're being able to take up and get involved in this kind of movement, this idea that it's not just about throwing out your anger or striking out or getting, you know, what's in it for me or anything like that, but the idea of being able to create this new society. At the same time, there's a lot of questions. There's a point here where a lot of people, as you said, you talked about the ideological revenge against communism, and that's led to a lot of different things about, you know, people being unsure of what they would be heading into, people being a little nervous about the unknown of what lies ahead of them, and thinking about it in terms of, you know, well, I know what I got here, I don't know what I have there, and there's a little bit of a, among some people, there can be a little bit of not being very sure about that. At the same time, they raise all these questions about, that come out, that are things that are really, I guess, I'm trying to think about this, there are things that are actually really gnawing in their brains. For instance, one big question that comes out, I've heard this from more than one person, many people actually, is the idea that, look, you can talk all you want about a new society, you can talk all you want about a new vision for humanity, but at the same time, there is a question of human nature. And people talk about that not just in the question of this sort of definable core of human nature, but they also talk about it in terms of people will do screwed up things, no matter what. And how will all that be dealt with? How can you actually deal with this kind of question? How can you bring a society in that would take into account this fact, and what would you do about it?
Well, you know, obviously these are big questions and deserve to be taken seriously and dug into. And this needs to happen in an ongoing way beyond what we can do here. But in our party, it does continue to address this. One of the main things that I've been speaking to and talks and writings, including a talk I gave not long ago, Birds Cannot Give Birth to Crocodiles, but Humanity Can Soar Beyond the Horizon, where I address the question of how the nature of the system, and most fundamentally the economic system, shapes the quote-unquote nature of the people in it. That is, the very character and dynamics of that system, or the system we live under, of capitalism, is a system based on exploitation, oppressive social relations between men and women, between different nationalities or races, as they're sometimes referred to. It rests on a fundamental division between people, a small group of people, relatively, who work with their minds, and then the realm of ideas and intellectual endeavor, and the great majority who are forced to work in physical labor, and other divisions in the world. All this is what the system rests on, thrives on, and reproduces and enforces. And it also brings forward the ideas that correspond to that and that reinforce that, and the culture. It's a system and a society based not only on exploitation and oppression, but on cutthroat competition at every level of society, including the highest level, where the different aggregations of capital, finance capital and corporate capital and so on, battle each other all over the world, in which this even results in wars as well as the destruction of the environment. That's the way the system, that's the nature of the system, if you will. And it produces a culture and shapes and influences the thinking of people to go along with and serve and reinforce that system. So the nature of the system conditions and shapes the nature of the human beings who are confined within and forced to live within the dynamics of that system. That's a very fundamental point. And, Marx made the point, founder of the communist movement, made the point some time ago, 150 years ago or so, that, as he put it, all of human history is the continuous transformation of human nature, that different societies are characterized by different cultures and different ways of thinking, which are fundamentally rooted in and correspond to the way that the economic mode of life, the way that the system organizes and conditions people and requires people to carry out economic activity in order to live and in keeping with the dynamics and requirements of that system. So that under slavery, for example, it was held to be the human nature of the slaves that slavery corresponded by the rulers of a society and the dominating ideas that this corresponded to the nature of the slaves and was actually in their best interest. These arguments were frequently made, especially by the slave owners and their representatives. Or in feudal society, there was the divine right of kings and the right of the nobles to rule over the lowly serfs and even to plunder the women of the serfs. All this was considered in keeping with God's will and the inherent and unchangeable nature of human beings. Then along came the bourgeois revolution, the capitalist revolutions, including the American, and you got people like Thomas Paine, representing a class of people rising who wanted to break off the fetters, at least some of the fetters of feudal restriction that kept the capitalist system from fully developing and hemmed it in, and including the whole superstructure of political rule of feudal society with monarchs and so on. So you got Thomas Paine, a radical in the context of the American bourgeois revolution, who vigorously argued against the whole notion of the right of monarchs to rule and divine right of kings and so on, and insisted, not without any reason, that this was a terrible system, that one of the things that could result from having hereditary kings and monarchs was that you could get mentally defective people and idiots, as well as very bad people, having an absolute right, divinely inspired, to rule. So the nature that was held to be unchallengeable under the feudal system, with the, enshrined and reinforced with the notion of a divine right of kings, got called into question fundamentally through the capitalist revolution, which wanted to break off the ways in which the limitations of feudalism and the way that the land was owned by landlords who, and things were very static, and the trade that could be carried out was restricted by all these different feudal manors that were divided up and kept them from fully developing the capitalist system, not only in the country, but in its international dimension and so on and so forth. The idea got challenged by the representatives of the bourgeois revolution, with whom we're all too familiar, one might say, whether Paine or Jefferson or whatever, that this whole idea of a monarchy and a static society where everybody's place was sort of predetermined, everybody had a place they were supposed to stay in, was challenged and overturned, both in the realm of the actual economic and political relations, but also in the realm of ideas. And these people brought forth the notion of a much more mobile society where capital could move from one place to another and people could move from one place to another according to the needs of capital. And just as happens today, you get immigrants forced to go thousands of miles chasing capital, in effect, to try to be able to find a livelihood when they're unable to any longer live where they are under the capitalist system. Capitalism needs a much more mobile workforce. It needs a workforce that isn't tied to a particular piece of land or a particular master. So the whole idea of that kind of static feudal society with these rigid delineations of different strata, you know, with everybody in their place up from bottom to top, was challenged and overturned under capitalism, and the notions of human nature that went along with that were also challenged and overturned. This is what Marx is getting at. Aha, somebody might say. The problem is, though, that even with all that, there is a thread that seems to be running through all this, which is the notion that some people should rule over and exploit others and have superior positions over others, even if it's not in the form of slavery or in the form of feudalism, as you just described it, but now in the form of modern-day society, whether they call it capitalism or democracy or whatever, where still you have some ruling over others, some people in a superior position, other people in an inferior position, and among all strata in society, people seem to be scrambling to try to beat each other out for whatever they deem to be their needs or their desires and aspirations. And there's some truth to that, of course. There's an essential truth to that, even, because what this system has in common, while it has many differences with feudalism or with outright slavery, this capitalist system is still a system based on exploitation and oppression, and still a system which drives people to be in conflict with each other over the daily necessities of life, to get a job, to get a place to live, for all the other things that people are driven to compete with each other over. So there is, even in this modern society, ways in which people are, and to put it in terms in which it's often popularly put, people are selfish and out for themselves, not because there's some unchangeable core to human beings that prevents them from being some other and better way, but because of the very dynamics of the system in which they are caught up and in which they're forced to live, which drives them to seek to gain advantage over others or to be pushed down by others who get advantage over them.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And this is part four of the five-part interview I recently did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this section of the interview deals with the question of, is it really possible to have a liberated socialist society with whole new ways of relating to each other and to the world, especially given the ideas that people have about human nature with all of its me first and screw the rest of you outlook? And also the question of what is revolutionary morality and what difference will it make in socialist society? Now, as I said earlier, this is part four of the five-part interview. If you've missed any of the first three parts, check it out at the KPFK archives or go to revcom.us.
And, I think, for example, in contrast to all that, when I went to China for the first time in 1971, we visited some of the rural areas where the peasants had gotten together and developed the people's communes, where they owned the land and worked the land in common, and their livelihood was increasingly improving. They were able to bring in more technology, more machinery, and continue to develop their output and contribute not only to their own well-being, but to the general development of society, and also to contribute to the world revolution by the support that was given by the central government to, for example, the Vietnamese struggle against the U.S. imperialists who were devastating the land and slaughtered several million people in the course of that war. And we were talking to some of these peasants who had their sights raised to much bigger things than just their own immediate circumstances and struggle, even while that, of course, remained something that they had to be and were concerned about. And people would tell us stories about how in the old society, most people were desperately poor, and there was mass starvation many years. I mean, the whole propaganda of this whole ideological assault, what I call the ideological revenge against communism, is somehow everybody was doing wonderfully in China. And everybody had lots of, surplus of everything they needed and had lots of luxury goods as well. And along came the communists and took it all away and caused everybody to suffer, which is, of course, the exact opposite of the truth. The reason people rallied to the leadership of the communists and made a revolution is because their conditions were the opposite of that. They were horrific, and people were dying of disease. People were dying of starvation many years. People were living in extreme hardship, even in the quote-unquote best of years, in their masses in the countryside. And the peasants there told us, when I visited in 1971, when we went around from different one commune to another, that look, in the old society, if we were lucky, we owned a small plot of land which we could make a meager existence off of, if we could even in that. We had, in the harsh winter, we had cotton clothes that had more holes than cloth in them, and we had to try to pad them, but we were always cold. We were always on the verge of starvation, if not literally in starvation. Some of us had the horror of having to sell some of our children to landlords or girl children who were sold into prostitution in order that other members of the family could survive. This is what our life was like. And as part of this, on our little meager plots of land, with the very small output that we could get from them, particularly at harvest time, everybody would stay up at night, or one member of the family at least would stay up at night to guard the plot and the output of the plot from their neighbors, because everybody was so desperate. People at each other's throats even on that level. But, they said, after the revolution came, there was a complete change of the economic system, of the political system. We became involved in the actual decision-making on the local level, but also contributing to that on the larger level of society. The relations changed between men and women. We began to collectivize the land and work it together and have a much better livelihood. Now nobody even would think about worrying about whether their neighbors are going to steal from them that way. Not that there's never any crime, or not that anybody never does anything selfish, but as a social problem, this no longer exists the way it did in the old society. Nobody would ever think that everybody on their own little small plot should stay up all night guarding it against their neighbors. And now, with the reversal of the revolution in China, after Mao died and the followers of Deng Xiaoping and Deng Xiaoping himself came to power, and the restoration of capitalism in that country and the turning of China, in fact, into a giant sweatshop for foreign imperialist capital as well as Chinese capital, all these conditions that people had won through the revolutionary struggle have been reversed. China went from having the most egalitarian healthcare system in the entire world during the period of socialism to having one of the most unequal healthcare systems, where everything is geared toward the wealthier strata of society and poor people, once again, have no decent healthcare. And we could go on and on just sketching out the ways in which this has thrown people back into the miserable conditions of the old society. Prostitution once again, drug addiction once again, big social problems where they had been eliminated as social problems in the socialist revolution, not by eliminating the former prostitutes or drug addicts, but by transforming the conditions, rehabilitating them, and by carrying out a struggle and education in society to make people broadly aware and to act on the understanding that the fact of women being prostitutes and people being drug addicts was not their own fault and should not be their own shame, but was the cause of the system, the rule of imperialism and the Chinese exploiters tied in with the imperialists, and the whole system which put people into these desperate conditions. All those kind of social things and the thinking that goes along with them, like prostitution, drug addiction, those kind of social problems and scourges have come back. And once again, the ideology of everybody being out for themselves has come back. And I think of a dramatic, it would almost be humorous if it weren't so perverse, a story I heard about two party members in the Chinese Communist Party, some years after Deng Xiaoping came to power and capitalism was restored. And they were talking, and one of them said to the other, back in the days of Mao, we used to talk about serving the people. That was what the revolution was supposed to be about. That was what the government was supposed to be about. That's what the Chinese Communist Party was supposed to be about. That was sort of the defining principle and guiding principle of the whole society. But now I think about it, and when I think about serve the people, it occurs to me, aren't I a people? And, the whole idea of going out for yourself once more, once you get to, the change in the whole nature of the government and the system brings back the old, quote-unquote, human nature. But this is not because this is an indelible thing in human beings that can't be changed, but it changed, and it's another illustration of Marx's point, that he got it when he said that all of human history is a transformation of human nature, that when the system is changed, then people's thinking also changes. Their way of relating to other people changes in accordance with the nature of the system that's been brought into being, in the case of a socialist revolution, a conscious activity of people. But if that revolution gets reversed, if a coup gets pulled from the top, which happened in China, and then the destruction of the socialist system is enforced now by the state that's ruled by these capitalist roaders, as Mao correctly called them, then you're going to get a new set of social and economic relations, and a new way and a new culture to reinforce that, and a new way of thinking, even among people who once again once knew much better.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And this is part four of the five-part interview I recently did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this section of the interview deals with the question of, is it really possible to have a liberated socialist society with whole new ways of relating to each other and to the world, especially given the ideas that people have about human nature with all of its me first and screw the rest of you outlook? And also the question of what is revolutionary morality and what difference will it make in socialist society? Now, as I said earlier, this is part four of the five-part interview. If you've missed any of the first three parts, check it out at the KPFK archives or go to revcom.us.
Tell me this. What about morality? Yeah, because there's a question. It's not exactly the same as the...
I'm for it.
Okay, let me mark that down. But, you know, you have a point in a way with all gods. And believe me, I've had many a discussion around this. You had the point about science can tell what is and what could be, but not what should be. And you talked about morality. And
right.
I keep thinking about that in relation to this point, getting away from even the human nature question, the idea that people aren't angels, people do things, the question of morality in a socialist society.
Yeah, when I said I'm for it, I'm for a revolutionary morality. You need a revolutionary morality, a socialist, a communist morality, if you're going to be able to actually make a revolution and bring into being a radically different socialist society and continue on the road toward eliminating all the inequalities and oppressive divisions that you've, to put it that way, inherited from the old capitalist society and then move on to a communist world, including the oppressive divisions between different countries that are part of the world we live in today very dramatically. So you need a revolutionary morality to be a guiding force in that, a morality that corresponds to the goal of actually overcoming and moving beyond all these oppressive divisions and inequalities. You need a morality that corresponds to that and that inspires people to fight for that. But it's true, simply the application of a scientific method and approach will not in itself settle the question of morality. And I think sometimes there's been a mechanical approach where people have thought, well, if you just have a science of communism, you'll automatically have the morality that goes along with it, and so morality is sort of irrelevant. And I think that's really wrong. And if we could use that term reductionist, it's vulgar materialist, if you want to put it that way. It's only looking at one element of the situation and thinking that in and of itself sort of automatically determines every other element. That if you have a new system, you'll sort of automatically have a new morality. And that's not true. There is a question of fighting in the realm of morality. What kind of morality are we going to have? And, you know, I think the question of science, let's put it this way. In a discussion with someone, I put it this way. In order to arrive at an understanding of why the world is the way it is, well, first of all, how it actually is and why it is the way it is and what can anything be done about that and what can be done and how. In order to answer those basic questions correctly and get to the core of this, not that you'll know everything about all that, but to get to the core of it and the essence of it, you need a scientific approach, and in particular the scientific approach of communism, which investigates, probes, and proceeds in accordance with actually trying to understand reality as it actually is and as it's moving through its contradictory motion and changing on that basis. And then, you know, acting in accordance with that to make changes in a way that actually is possible given that material reality. That's the point about communism. It's not just some utopian idea. The point is that the conditions that have been brought into being in the world, not conditions that were bound to occur or an inevitable result of some human development or some master plan of a god or nature or whatever, but that way things have actually developed. The technology, the knowledge that exists, the interconnectedness and interdependence of human beings, even though this is now under a highly oppressive system which leads to all kinds of inequalities among those human beings. But the fact that we're interconnected, interdependent, all that provides the material basis, if you analyze it scientifically, to make the leap first to socialism and then to go on to overcome the remaining inequalities, both in particular countries and in the world, and get to communism. If you analyze it scientifically, you can see that possibility as well as that necessity in order to really meet the needs of the great majority and ultimately all of humanity. But you can also analyze or recognize, in any case, in basic terms, the same conditions, the same reality that we've been discussing here, and decide to do nothing about it. Because your position is relatively comfortable, or because you feel that even though you don't like all that, it requires too much sacrifice, or you don't think the prospect is realistic. Now, the science will help you determine whether or not the prospect is actually realistic, whether there's a basis in the real world to do this, even though it may be very difficult and require tremendous and in many ways wrenching struggle. But that science won't tell you what to do with that knowledge. There does enter in the realm where there has to be struggle in the realm of morality. That's where the realm of morality enters in, and the necessity for struggle in the realm of morality. And as I put it to someone in a discussion, science does not settle the question of morality and what to do with what science reveals about the world and reality. There is a need for morality to take the next leap in terms of what you're going to do about what you've come to understand. But if your morality flows from assumptions, or in any case is out of keeping with the actual reality and is in conflict with actual reality, then sooner or later your morality is bound to lead you in a wrong direction, even if your intentions are good. So science doesn't settle the question of morality. There still is the realm of morality in its own right, so to speak, and the necessity for struggle to win people to a revolutionary, to a communist morality. But all that has to have a scientific foundation. Otherwise, even with the best of intents, you're going to go off course and lead people, you know, in the wrong direction. So that's how I see that. There is a very great importance to morality. Now, I know what you sort of were, you know, implying here, or you know, we're suggesting, is that many people say, well, what you're talking about sounds good, but it'd only work if people were angels, quote unquote. This is the old thing, if you know, if it used to be said in the old days, if men were angels, you know, if people were angels, then okay, we wouldn't need, you know, the kind of society we have. But once again, we're back to, since people are not angels, they're basically selfish and out for self above all, etc., then we can't have the kind of society you're talking about. We have to have a society that corresponds to that. And lo and behold, guess what? It's the society we have now. So, you know, but then let's go directly to this question. Do people have to be, quote unquote, perfect or angels in order for this revolution and its goal of first socialism and ultimately a communist world to actually be realized? No.
Yep, that's where we're ending. No. Do people have to be angels or be perfect in order for this revolution and its goal of first socialism and then a communist world to be realized? No. And we'll pick it up right there next week as he goes on to explain why he says that. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and you've been listening to an interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, just a little while ago. And this is the part 4 of 5 segments. If you've missed any of the first 3 segments, and if you want to just get this segment to, you know, download it, have it to you so you can take it out to your friends and whatnot, go to the KPFK archives at kpfk.org or visit revcom.us. That's revcom.us. All right. And you'll get all you need there. You can download the whole interview as it plays, and you'll get a whole lot more information about this movement for revolution that's led by Avakian.